Support for Looking Up comes from Cincinnati Museum Center, presenting Destination Moon, the Apollo 11 mission. You can see more than 20 objects flown aboard the historic Apollo 11 mission, plus the command module Columbia, the only portion of the historic spacecraft to survive the lunar journey. Open now at Cincinnati Museum Center.
Hey, Anna, big news from Saturn and the ringed planet.
Oh my gosh.
20, count them, 20 new moons were discovered very recently, all at once.
Did you discover them?
I wish I discovered even
one of them. Oh my gosh. You know, you could tell me you did, and I'd be like, cool.
Yes, I 7 out of the 20 are going to be named Dean.
Oh my gosh.
So,
I love it.
Yes. I found them all by myself with my little telescope. And this was something, it was kind of out of the blue.
It's
20 all at once were found, bringing Saturn's moon total to a whopping 82. So imagine if we had 82 moons in our sky, what it would be like.
It would be so bright.
Very bright.
I think.
You'd have to keep track of which ones are which up in the sky.
Yeah.
Each one would have its own association.
Now
we got the one, which is all just like, it's just cool.
It's the star.
Yeah.
I mean no pun intended. No, or whatever, yeah.
The moon.
It's the moon.
Yeah, I mean, it's the moon. Doesn't even have a name.
Like, yeah, it's like Cher.
Moon, right.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So now we got to come up with 20 more names for these 20 new moons.
I could do it right now.
Go.
I'm just kidding.
give me a few.
I blanked. I was just kidding. I don't have anything.
All right. Well, see. We'll have to.
Okay, fine. We'll name 7 of them Dean. That's great.
All right, 7 of them Dean.
The 13
a few
left.
Of them Anna, and then we'll throw in a few others for good measure.
Love it.
From the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, this is Looking Up, and I'm Dean Regas.
And I'm Anna Heeman, and we're both from the Cincinnati Observatory. Dean's the astronomer, and I've got a lot of curiosity. On this episode, we're talking about the Mars 2020 rover project with Deputy Project Scientist Ken Williford. Man, I really missed my opportunity there to just rattle off 20 moon names.
Right, right.
I can't even think of anything. I'm
John,
tired.
Paul, George, Ringo.
That's right. I was trying to think of some, like, punny names.
Right.
That would be funny. But I can't really.
Pattern.
Think.
Mattern.
Mattern.
No, okay. See, this is hard.
It is hard. I mean, but if I discovered something like 20 moons,
yeah.
Which, let's talk about that. How, they've been there, or do they, like, scoot over from other part of space?
What? That's a valid question. Is, you know, like.
Don't sound surprised.
How do they? No.
Like, how, oh, do my they, God, that was cogent.
Well, that was the first thing I thought.
Yeah.
Was like, well. Where were they before? What's
right.
These astronomers are totally dropping the ball. I mean, like,
shh.
I mean, they're
getting
really lazy.
Lazy.
Yeah, 20 moons. I mean, they just missed them all of a sudden.
They should have introduced them in, like, we found a couple.
Yeah,
and then
like,
we found a couple more until they reach 20, so they don't look like they're totally lazy.
You know, that's a really, that'd be better PR.
I know.
Instead, the all at once. Now it's all over and people are already over it.
Yeah. And then I could name them a couple at a time to go back. But it's not about me. It's not about me. It's fine. Right.
So it was a team led by Scott Shepard, an American astronomer, mm-hmm. who came up with these. And he was going over old data, like old telescope data that people have been collecting.
Okay.
And there's so many giant telescopes collecting so much data, it's like stacked up. And so people are going through this old stuff looking for things that people missed. And so it is. It's exactly that. It's stuff that people missed back then. And so he goes through this old data, these old files, and finds 20 new things that have never been seen before. And
so in other things that have already been seen, he didn't look in a telescope and be like, yeah, they are.
Yeah.
It was like, this is,
yeah,
we already found,
yeah,
these
so
a while ago.
It's one of those.
Paperwork, you know.
Exactly. It's like paperwork. And this is a field of astronomy where people do this. They look through the old files and see if there's old things that people missed.
Yeah.
And I mean, we go back to, you know, the most, I guess the first one would be Galileo. He makes on his star chart all these stars and put Neptune on the chart.
Uh-huh.
He didn't know it was Neptune, and nobody found Neptune for another 200 and some years.
He just, like, drew a star.
He drew it, and we went back, and we're like, yep, that was, he actually saw Neptune, didn't know what it was.
You can't get mad at Galileo. He had a lot going on.
Yeah, I mean,
he was busy.
He just made his own telescope.
And, yeah, you know, geez.
Don't expect him to find Neptune.
I mean, he did find it. He didn't know he found
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And so so these 20 new moons just came up. And, and so now that brings, Saturn is the moon king now with 82.
You just make that up?
The moon king? Nah, I think somebody else said that.
Really?
I don't know. It's
so it has 82
moons. Jupiter is close behind at 79. And
It is close behind. Yeah,
so 12 of them were found in the same way just recently. I think it was about a year or two ago. They found 12 new ones.
There's probably going to be more.
There certainly should be. And and so it does beg the question, what's a moon? You know, how small can you be to be a moon? And these moons, these 20 moons, are all about 3 kilometers in diameter. So you could do a quick race around these moons in no time and come back to where you started from. And so they're tiny, but they're also almost a billion miles away. And so the fact that we can see this 3 kilometer thing from a billion miles away is crazy. And I know I just interspersed metric and regular non-metric things, which, sorry, listeners, I'm still not on board with metric yet. So I'm working on it.
Notice he didn't apologize to me.
Sorry, Anna.
I'm sitting here trying to deal with this and figure this out myself.
I mean, 3 kilometers, I know.
He's I'm over here doing math.
I don't know what 3 kilometers actually is. I'm just repeating what they said.
That's tricky. Yeah. 2.2 miles or meter? Is that a whatever?
Yeah.
We're American.
I'm sorry. I'm still going to be American, at least for now. I love to be international and metric, but.
That's right.
I'm working on it.
Exactly. So then they found them. Now, you know, what are the chances they're going to find some more moons around other planets? Since it's like, what if someone just hasn't gotten to that paperwork yet?
Yeah, I know. It's. I mean, they're pretty sure about Mercury, Venus, Mars. Those ones are pretty well documented. So, you know, Mercury is easy, zero moons. Venus, zero moons.
Obviously.
And Mars, two. I'll go back to your earlier question. You said, well, could these be new moons that weren't moons before?
Or just like drifted in.
And so these little moons around Saturn, Jupiter, they are most likely captured asteroids. So they were things that just strayed a little too close to these planets and got trapped by their gravity wells. And so now so they probably are new additions, but astronomers new means tens of thousands of years, not last Wednesday. So, but it's possible that they were just captured recently. And again, that's the last tens of thousands of years. But that's pretty recent for us.
Yeah, for us. Yeah. That's true. Tens of thousands of years. That's like yesterday.
Yep.
Wow. Well, that's exciting.
Yeah, and I think they're going to find more. It's just a matter of time. Our technology's getting better. We're able to see smaller and smaller things from farther and farther away. So I would imagine that the next, if I were reading this astronomer's mind, Scott Shepard and his team, he already went by Jupiter, got 12 there, 20 at Saturn. You got to go look at Uranus and Neptune next. And so
you're not Pokemon. You're not like collecting, like, I got moons here. Like, let's see what you got, Neptune or Uranus or whoever else they're going to look for.
There is a game out there, and the astronomers play it. They're like, you know, we got to be the first ones to see it. They are highly competitive nerds. I mean, like, think of like, these are not just your normal, like, I'm going to stay at home and read books. They're like, cutthroat. They're like, I got to find these moons before so-and-so does.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I don't think there's rivalries like, you know,
you don't
east
seem
side,
concerned.
West side. I don't think it's like that. But they
you
can.
You seem fine about it.
Yeah. I mean, so, yeah, that's awesome that they're, but I would say Uranus, Neptune, better watch out. I think they're going to start surveying those and they might find some more moons there.
It's exciting.
Well, I know Saturn's making the headlines, but we're really excited about a new rover that is being readied for a trip to Mars next year, and it has some new upgrades and tools to assist with its research. One thing it doesn't have is a name, but we're excited to talk about all of this with Ken Williford, the Deputy Project Scientist for the Mars 2020 Project. Ken, thanks so much for joining us today.
Happy to do it.
Well, so we're really excited about this new Mars mission taking off next year. Give us the details. What's the timeline of launch and arrival and all that?
Right. Well, the mission is called Mars 2020, and we are scheduled to launch in July of 2020, so a bit less than a year away. Very exciting time for the mission. We will cruise to Mars, fly from Earth to Mars over the course of about 7 months to arrive mid-February 2021, at which point we will start our surface mission And these NASA missions generally have what's called a prime mission, and that is the normal or nominal length of the mission that is currently funded and so forth. And of course, the spacecraft may last longer than that, but that is what is officially scheduled and planned. And that for us is one Mars year, which is right at about two Earth years. So we'll spend two of our Earth years exploring our landing site at Jezero Crater. And then if everything is working well and the resources permit, we would get an extended mission after that, during which we could drive further afield. So that's our basic timeline.
That's exciting. And we saw that, so there's not a name for the rover, is that right?
That's right. We have a naming contest that is open now.
Oh my gosh. I already solved the problem for you, though. I thought of the name for it. Do you want to hear it?
She has a suggestion. Oh, she's perfect. Been dying to tell you.
That's right.
Yeah, lay it on me.
The Bruno Mars rover.
Oh, nice.
That's not that bad. It's like a before and after kind of thing.
Yeah. And even I know who Bruno Mars is, which is shocking. So at least even I get it.
I don't think Ken's as excited about the idea as I was.
Well, you know, it's not bad.
I'm not going to assume anything about your age, but this is a contest for children.
So. Oh!
And the name has to come with an essay to be eligible to win.
Oh, an essay.
I'll get to writing.
That's a smart move. You make it a little tougher on those kids.
That's a great idea, though, a naming contest for kids. I got it,
yes.
For kids.
Yes, all right. Check. Take you off the list.
Anyway.
And that's how we got the name Curiosity for the rover that's currently cruising around on Mars as part of the Mars Science Laboratory mission. And our rover will look almost exactly like the Curiosity rover, kind of to the untrained eye, but there are some important details and differences that we might get to.
Well, with the Mars 2020 mission and the yet-to-be-known named rover, what's the mission going to be looking for? What's the main goals?
Yeah, so we have four main objectives, and those are, number one, to do geology. So like the Curiosity rover, we are a robotic geologist, so we land in a new environment to us to explore. It's actually a very old environment where the rocks we'll be looking at were deposited somewhere between 3 and 4 billion years ago. So a very, very long time ago, right around the time when we believe life was first starting to emerge on planet Earth. But one of the great things about Mars is that unlike Earth, it did not have plate tectonics. It may never have had plate tectonics, but if it did, it did not in the way that Earth has. And that process on Earth, plate tectonics, has destroyed most of the earliest record of Earth's history. So the first billion years of Earth's evolution has been destroyed geologically. On Mars, that record is preserved. And so we're looking back into that window of deep ancient time, which doesn't really exist on Earth. And that gets us to our second objective, which is to understand, number one, was Mars, was this environment that we're exploring habitable? That is, could it have supported life at one time? And then number two, did life exist in that environment? So we're looking for any evidence of ancient life, you know, that would have existed at the time those rocks were deposited, you know, some three and a half billion years ago on Mars. And then the third objective is, as we do our what we call our in situ science, the science that we do on the surface of Mars with our different scientific instruments, as we make all those observations, we'll select in our exploration environment some specific locations that we think have the best chance of having preserved any of those signs of ancient life or signs of planetary evolution generally, and we'll sample those. So like the Curiosity rover, Mars 2020 has a drill, but unlike the Curiosity rover, our drill makes cores. So the Curiosity rover drill makes powder, and it brings that powder into instruments onboard the rover. Our rover is different. We take a core of rock, and we seal that in a titanium tube, and we leave that sample-filled tube on the surface of Mars. Now, that sounds strange. Why in the world would we do that? Well, that's because we're the first mission of a possible Mars sample return multi-mission campaign. So it's our job to do all that science I described, choose locations to sample, collect those core samples, and we've got 42 tubes on board, so we can collect quite a few samples, leave those in a collection on the surface of Mars such that a future mission could come and pick those up and eventually get them back to Earth. And it actually takes a couple missions to get that whole thing done. Why would we want to do that? Well, that's because when you send a scientific instrument to Mars, you have to make it very small and very light. And so because of that, the instruments that we send to space can never be as good as the best instruments that we have back on Earth. And so someday we'd like to get those samples from Mars back on Earth to analyze with our most powerful instruments that we have here. And so that's this concept of Mars sample return. And then the final objective is we're preparing for future human exploration. And so a couple of our instruments, the weather station called META, and then something called MOXIE, which generates oxygen from CO2 in the Mars atmosphere, are specifically designed to prepare for future human exploration of Mars. But in a sense, everything we do better prepares us to send humans to Mars and get them back safely. The more we know about the planet, the better prepared we are to do that. So that's our mission in a nutshell.
So, well, this is really cool to have a sample return, that possibility for the future to get actual piece of Mars from one of these rovers. And so what do you think it is about what's the fascination people have with Mars? What's why Mars out of all other places in the solar system?
Yeah, well, Mars is our planetary neighbor. I think you can think of Venus, Earth, and Mars as kind of three distinct planetary destinies, in a sense, and three planets that might have been very similar when they first were formed, but took three very different tracks. So, of course, we know the track Earth took, and it's a very friendly track for life and for us. We still have oceans and an atmosphere that allows us to breathe and plenty of organisms on the planet. Venus had what we call a runaway greenhouse. So much of the greenhouse gases inside the planet filled up its atmosphere so that, you know, the greenhouse effect we talk about on Earth and global warming and all that, that happened to an extreme degree on Venus, such that the surface is so hot that you can melt lead, right? So not a friendly environment for living organisms. And then Mars, in a sense, had the opposite fate. It lost almost all of its atmosphere to space. And while it may once have had an ocean, that ocean, you know, if it existed, has been lost to space. And so it's a very cold and dry place, in a sense, the opposite of Venus. But I think that the scientific fascination is that all three of these were very similar to Earth back, you know, several billion years ago, but Mars kind of uniquely gives us the best opportunity to go look at that earliest record of planetary formation and potentially the emergence of life on a planet much life like Earth. Then, of course, you know, there have been all the science fiction books and movies and so forth, and Mars having been associated with the god of war, and, you know, I think that just tends to capture people's imagination.
Well, I think despite that, you might have convinced Anna that Mars would be better than Venus. I mean, melting lead versus cold.
Yeah.
You even said you go cold over hot.
I go cold over hot any day of the week.
All right. So yeah. She's volunteering for the next
Mars. Let me get the human trials.
Mars 2026. She's on board for the human trial.
Uh-oh.
Excellent.
After the sample return.
To visit the Bruno Mars rover.
There we go. Exactly. Well, Ken, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. Thanks so much for giving us the update on Mars 2020, and we'll be looking forward to seeing it launch next year.
Yeah, me too. Thanks a lot.
All right, take care. We've been talking with Ken Williford, the Deputy Project Scientist for NASA's Mars 2020 project.
Well, there's always so many questions, and fortunately, hopefully, we have time for some answers with this segment. Kid question.
All right.
Haven't done it in a while, I feel like. But we love hearing from kids of all ages. So here's a question we received recently from one of our producers,
very
our engineer,
recently.
Very recently, about this moon business with Saturn. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, great. So Josh wanted to know.
Our child producer.
Childish. It says producer. Kids of all ages in the script, so it's totally fine.
Yeah, yeah.
We
just want to make sure they're not employing, you know, like 12-year-olds here at Cincinnati Public Radio.
There is no sweatshop.
Okay, yeah. He's an adult.
He's an adult. He's an adult man working.
Yes.
That's right. So he wanted to know, you know, all these moons now with Saturn, can you, like, jump from one moon to the other? Is it, like, a crowded space? What's happening?
Well, there is yes.
Is
the answer, and that's the fun part about these moons is imagining what it's like to actually visit one of these.
Yeah.
So again, going back to my metric units, it's 3 kilometers in diameter. Which
what is that? Why would you
it's like
use
2 miles? I don't know. It's what the
oh
fancy.
My God.
So let's say 2 miles.
We need a.
So it's 2 miles in diameter, and so the gravity, the force of gravity of these little objects is very, very weak. And so with some of them, you could jump off of them. You could physically, like, just jump.
Like, leap off.
And leap off, and you're gone, like Superman. And
oh
you'd be
God.
Out into space. Now,
okay,
the likelihood
terrifying.
Of you running into another moon would be very, very, very low.
So I can't jump from one to the other.
Unless you really know where you're going. Like, if you can know
I
the exact know force that you could jump off of. And
That's why
it's rocket science. It's because if you want to actually go from one moon to the other, you have to leave at the exact right time with the exact right velocity.
Okay.
And so, but
trajectory.
Exactly. All that.
I'm going to throw some fancy
words
out.
But you could jump off a moon. Now, you could also, if you get it just right, you could jump off of a moon in a way that you would then start circling the moon.
What?
Like you would jump off of the moon and then start falling back, but missing the moon, and you'd circle around. Like you'd be the moon of that moon.
I would be, it would be like a meta, like on the moon of the moon, and then something falls out of my pocket. It starts orbiting me. It's the moon of the moon. I mean, that sounds like some kind of Russian doll situation.
Yeah.
Where they just
then,
like keep opening up.
And then you take an apple and you release the apple, and then it's going to be a moon around you. And then the apple will be
right,
the moon of
saying.
A moon of a moon.
And then it's going to, I mean, it just, this sounds like, I mean, it's just like chaos.
Yeah. Now, I haven't done the computations on what the gravity of these moons would be, but we crunched the numbers on one of the comets. So this is another, this is an object about similar in size, you know, a couple miles across. And what we found out was the escape velocity, the amount of velocity you need to get off of that object, like you go into space.
Okay.
Was only about 2.5 miles per hour. So if you could move 2.5 miles an hour.
How fast even is that?
That's
so slow.
That is a walking speed.
Yeah.
So if you walk, if you take a normal step on Earth, that normal step on that comet would take you out into space. You'd be gone. You'd fly into space. So you have to like go very, very slowly and tiptoe and like not sneeze. You could sneeze yourself off of that moon.
You like sneeze, you shoot yourself.
Yeah. You're like, yeah. And then you're gone. I mean, it's almost impossible to stay on the moon.
That's terrifying.
And so isn't that, I don't know, it's kind of fun to think about.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's great.
Because we see all these,
like my worst nightmare,
all the movies and TV shows where they visit other planets. They never like factor in what the actual gravity would be.
That's true.
And
it really bugs you, I know.
You got to think about that stuff. If you're going to go visit these little moons, you're going to be weighing almost nothing, which would feel great. You feel like so light, but
yeah,
one wrong step, you're gone.
That's it.
No coming back.
Well, that's it for this episode of Looking Up. Thanks again to Ken Williford from the Mars 2020 Project for joining us. You'll find the Name the Rover contest on our website at wvxu.org/lookingup.
If you're new to Looking Up, welcome. You've missed a lot of great conversations with people like William Shatner, Commander Scott Kelly, Ellen Stofan from the Smithsonian Space Museum, and lots more. You'll find the archives of all our past episodes at wvxu.org/lookingup.
We love talking with guests like Ken Williford. If there's someone from the space and astronomy world that you'd like to hear on Looking Up, let us know. Our email is lookingup@wvxu.org.
You can subscribe to Looking Up wherever you listen to podcasts. And please give us a rating and comment on Apple Podcasts. Those are incredibly helpful and we really appreciate it.
Our theme song and additional music is by Y, that's W-H-Y ? From their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer, Josh Elstro is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provides additional technical assistance.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.